Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro, and this week my guest is science fiction writer and biographer Alec Nevala Lee. Alec, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Great to be here.
For the listeners, you are a science fiction novelist and essayist. You're known for the sci-fi novels The Icon Thief, City of Exiles, and The Eternal Empire. You've written for Analog Science Fiction, and you've had essays and nonfiction published in the Los Angeles Times, Salon, The Daily Beast, and more. And your latest book, a biography, is a nonfiction, Astounding, a critical look at the life, writing, and influence of four famous science fiction authors, John W. Campbell, Isaac Asimov, Robert I. Heinlein, L. Ron Hubbard, during the golden age of science fiction in the 1940s and 50s. And I want to get into that at length in the second half of the show. But first, I want to talk to you about your science fiction career and growing up in California and your science fiction reading. So who influenced you when you were younger?
Sure. So I was born in 1980. All right. So I come from actually like a later generation of writers than the authors that I talk about in my new book. And growing up, you know, my influences were things like The X-Files. Sherlock the X-Files was a big influence on me growing up. And a lot of my stories and a lot of the stuff I've written over time has kind of been geared that direction. And so it was kind of a change of pace for me to turn to people like Asimov and Heinlein because, I mean, I'd read their work growing up and, you know, I knew who they were. And, you know, I was always, you know, like fascinated by that period of science fiction. But it wasn't until, you know, about 3 years ago, when I started thinking about this project, that I really went back and kind of read a lot of the stuff that, you know, I might have read years and years earlier, but just never got around to.
So when you go to the Barnes & Noble these days and you look in the science fiction section, there's a lot of books by popular modern authors, and a lot of it's fantasy as opposed to hard science fiction. And you won't necessarily see books by Harlan Ellison and Robert Heinlein in print so much anymore, bursting over the shelves. So how did you come across these guys?
The library. You know, I think I've talked to a lot of writers who talk about going to the library when they were probably 12, which, you know, someone once said, I mean, 12 years old is the real golden age of science fiction. You know, the stuff you read at that age, you know, is you never get over it. Right.
I grew up on Heinlein.
Yeah. Yeah. And that stuff, you know, stays with you. I've talked to several people who talk about going to the library and looking for the icon of a rocket ship on the spine of books, you know, in the science fiction section, and just kind of going through that. And, you know, I would say that growing up, I was, a voracious reader. You know, I loved fiction of all kinds. And I discovered books like Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game series, you know, was another big book for me at that time. I read some Heinlein. I loved Asimov's nonfiction, especially. But, you know, it was not very systematic. You know, it's kind of like the way people read. You kind of just go here and there and you kind of look at whatever catches your eye. And it wasn't until recently that I was like, okay, I need to go through and kind of take a more systematic look at how science fiction really came to be what it is now. You know, I kind of read in this very haphazard way growing up, the way we all tend to. And it wasn't until very recently that I said I should probably go back and try to read through the history of science fiction more systematically to figure out how it kind of became what it is today.
What were some of your favorite science fiction authors besides Card and Heinlein and Asimov? You mentioned in your bio you were a big fan of some of the other authors that I had never heard of, actually.
If we're talking about, you know, my very, very first influences, I mean, I think this is a book a lot of people these days talk about is A Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine L'Engle, who, you know, changed my life when I was 8 years old. And, you know, I mean, that book, I got to say, probably is more responsible than any other for making me want to be a writer. And, you know, I would say a lot of other writers would say the same thing. So growing up, that was a big deal for me. You know, certainly, Card was someone that I devoured growing up. I can't say I read a lot of his stuff these days. You know, and I love short science fiction. You know, I love reading anthologies. You know, some of the first stories I ever read were, there's a great anthology called The 100 Great Short Science Fiction Stories that Asimov co-edited back in probably the late 70s. And those were the first stories that I'd ever read that had appeared in Astounding and in Analog and in the classic pulps.
Now, Astounding was a pretty old magazine published in the 30s. That was the precursor to Analog. So where did where did you find the Astounding? I guess the library, right?
Well, you know, I mean, anthologies were a big part of the process, you know, both then and now. I think anthologists have a lot of power over what stories get remembered and what stories get read. And so, you know, I had probably one or two anthologies of these stories growing up that I read. And, you know, I don't even think I was that aware of who the authors were. I just kind of read these stories and memorized them. And I was looking back at one of those anthologies recently, and I saw names like Barry Malzberg and George R. R. Martin and Joanna Russ and, you know, all these other people who I'm like, oh, wow, I was reading this stuff when I was 12 years old, and I didn't even know it.
Well, how did your interest in science fiction as a youngster translate into your aspirations in college? And your bio looked like you were a classicist in Latin and Greek. What happened there? I would have predicted physics and astronomy.
Yeah, you know, you would think so. I mean, my ambition was always to be a writer, full stop. I didn't really have a particular genre I wanted to be associated with exclusively. And, you know, I was writing novels early on, you know, unpublished, of course, but, you know, I wrote my first novel heavily influenced by someone like Orson Scott Card when I was 13 years old on, like, you know, a MS-DOS computer with a dot matrix printer. And I still have that manuscript somewhere. And I was writing science fiction all the way through high school. And I knew I wanted to be a novelist. I knew I wanted to write short fiction. I knew I wanted to do nonfiction. And frankly, classics, you know, and this is what I'm talking about, is like actually learning how to read and write Latin and Greek, you know, seemed to me like kind of the serious-minded way to become a good writer, because I would learn a lot about grammar. I would learn a lot about the history of literature. I would just sort of acquire all these skills along the way that I could then kind of put to use, you know, later on. And that's actually kind of how it turned out. I did not pursue classics past the undergraduate level, but the stuff I learned in college, you know, I use that stuff every day.
Where did you go to college?
Harvard.
Oh, cool. Was that tough to get into?
Yeah. I mean, looking back now, I can kind of appreciate how lucky I was, because yes, it was a big deal to go there, and I met some amazing people, and I had just fantastic opportunities. You know, great teachers and books, and you know, it was a huge part of my life, and you know, it definitely left me with certain values and certain ideas about, you know, what it meant to be like a thinking person, and what it meant to be a writer, and what it meant to engage with you know, the history of our culture.
Did you come to find that your relative lack of background in science influenced the nature of your writing? Were you a little bit uneasy about getting into some of the harder science?
You know, it definitely did. So my career as a science fiction writer is mostly on the short fiction side. And I sent my first story to Analog when I was 23 years old. And I published there probably about a dozen stories over the past 15 years. And most of my stories, you know, they aren't quite your typical Analog story. They're mostly set in the present day or in the near future on this world. You know, I don't do outer space. I don't do, you know, far future. I keep things very grounded. And part of the reason is that, you know, my background is not in physics. It's not in engineering. And so a lot of the hard science fiction tropes, I'm not saying I wouldn't love to do them at some point, but I feel there are other writers who are probably more qualified than I am. And so I've had to kind of carve out my particular niche, which, in my case, has been sort of near future, very, you know, slipstream kind of uncanny stories, which are based on science, but they're always based on a very, you know, kind of specific piece of science that I can master for the space of 10,000 words and kind of feel confident about my accuracy for this, like, very narrow slice of it. You know, I think the results are pretty interesting. You know, I think I've been forced to seek out unusual themes and ideas because of the fact that my background is not sort of what you'd associate with your typical Analog writer.
The name Harlan Ellison comes to mind as somebody who wasn't known to be strong in physics and science and astronomy, but wrote really, really well and with power and emotion.
Yeah, I mean, Ellison is, you know, obviously a fascinating figure and, yeah, no, a great role model, at least in that respect, you know, someone whose imagination and whose personality was so strong that it didn't matter. You know, he was just really good. And, you know, he kind of supplied all the background he needed.
Wanted to ask you about right after graduation, because I'm fascinated by the transition. You, after graduation from Harvard, you went out and got a job, and then you didn't keep that very long and then decided to become a novelist. I want to hear about that story.
Well, I mean, so I worked for about 3.5 years at actually a financial firm in New York. And it was not my sort of initial plan after graduation. My goal was to be a full-time writer, which I soon discovered is very hard, right? It's financially, you know, very dicey, and it takes years to get to the point where you can even start to think about supporting yourself. And so I lucked out. I landed a nice job that I think, I would have really enjoyed, for a long time. But, you know, I was also trying to write and I was trying to finish a novel and I just couldn't do it. And I realized, you know, at some point that it's very hard to work a full-time job for 9-10 hours and then come home and write for 3 hours. It's, you know, people do it, but after several years of trying, I had a bunch of false starts. I had some chapters I'd written, but nothing I'd ever finished. And so I said, you know, I got to make a choice. And so I essentially downscaled my life. I saved some money long enough to write at least one novel, and I quit my job. And it didn't quite pay off overnight. But looking back, you know, I don't think I'd be doing the things I'm doing now if I hadn't made that choice.
Yeah, it's a tough job because you have to spend a lot of time writing, and then the reward comes at the end, if at all, and in pieces and royalty payments. Yeah. So what was your favorite tool for writing at this point? This must have been like 2000s.
Yeah, I mean, 2005 is when I probably started writing more seriously. I've always worked on a Mac. You know, I'm sitting at mine now. just a little plug there. So like almost everyone these days, I write it, you know, on something like Microsoft Word. I think that's pretty standard. But, you know, working with pen and paper for certain stages of the process is hugely important to me. You know, I think I have better ideas, and I think that my creativity levels are a little different when I'm actually writing something down by hand. So I always make sure to have a notebook handy. I, you know, do a lot of brainstorming on paper and, you know, work out as much of it as I can that way before I sit down and start typing.
That's a real trick, to be able to think and create and plan while you're typing. Not everybody can do it.
Yeah. No, I mean, my favorite advice about writing that I ever read was from the playwright David Mamet, who I think is one of the most interesting people when it comes to talking about craft. And he says that, you know, he's learned to take things one step at a time. And so he'll do something one day that doesn't require any cleverness at all, like making a literal outline. And so I don't have to be clever. I just have to do this one, you know, particular thing. And then on day two, you're like, okay, I already have this literal outline. So now I just have to be a little bit clever and write the dialogue. So, you know, I found that by kind of breaking up the process in that way, it's actually much easier to get things done.
Well, we're coming to the end of the first segment of the show. And in the second half, I want to talk to you about your new biography, Astounding. But first, we have to take this short commercial break. Folks, I'm chatting with science fiction writer and biographer Alex Nevala-Lee. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm chatting with Alec Nevala Lee. I'll get that right.
You got it. That's good.
Okay. So great. So let's talk about your new book. It's called Astounding. It comes out pretty soon. And it is, as I said in the introduction, sort of a critical analysis of the writing and influence of four authors. So how did you pick those four authors? And backing up, what inspired you to do that in the first place?
So as I mentioned, I've been writing for Analog, which is what Astounding is known as these days, for a long time. And at one point, it kind of occurred to me that I should write a nonfiction book about the history of the magazine. And at that stage, what I had in mind was kind of like a book where I would just sit down and just read through the whole run of Astounding and write like a critical commentary on those stories. But as I started to do my research, I realized that there had never been a biography of John W. Campbell, all right, who was the most influential editor of Astounding and Analog. And, you know, this fact still amazes me because Campbell is such a natural subject for a book like this. You know, he's so interesting. He's so controversial. He's so important.
What was your source material for him? How did you find out about him and his life?
Well, you know, you read things like Asimov's memoirs, right? And which are really fascinating in themselves. And he talks about Campbell as his father figure. You know, this is the guy who mentored him and kind of, you know, was responsible for his career as a science fiction writer. Mm. And so you read that and you read sort of other anecdotal stories. And especially you read about his association with L. Ron Hubbard. So, you know, these are things that I was aware of. You know, I had not spent a lot of time thinking about Campbell until then. But, you know, the second I realized that, you know, this subject was available, I was like, I got to write this book, you know, and that's kind of how it started.
I think John W. Campbell was before my time. I remember reading Analog and when I was younger, and he was still the editor, but I didn't remember reading much of his work. What was significant about the way Campbell wrote?
So Campbell's career as a writer was actually pretty short. So he wrote during his you know, late teens, early 20s, and became the editor of Astounding when he was 27 years old. And this is 1937. So he was very young when he stopped writing. But in that period, he generated, you know, some amazing stories. On the one hand, he became kind of a famous writer of what's called super science. So these very kind of like, you know, hardware focused space opera stories that are, you know, I mean, they frankly don't hold up that well. I think at least Campbell's stories are pretty dated. But then under a pen name, Don A. Stewart, he wrote some amazingly atmospheric, evocative stories like Twilight. And the most famous story is Who Goes There, which I think is probably, you know, the single greatest science fiction suspense story ever written that I've kind of been unconsciously rewriting my entire career.
I vaguely remember that. Can you tell us about that?
Who Goes There? Yeah. You know, you might know it best from its adaptations as The Thing. But, you know, it is the story of this Antarctic expedition that has to deal with a shape-shifting alien, you know, and you don't know who, you know, who to trust, whether the person in front of you is your friend or your enemy. It's a great premise. It's a great story. And he when he was 27 years old, he'd already kind of written the best story that I think in some ways anybody would ever write.
Cool. All right, let's move on. We got to check in with Isaac Asimov. I was talking to my wife the other day about Isaac Asimov, and I asked her to name a couple famous physicists, and she spun off a few names, and then I said, name me a famous biochemist.
Yeah.
And she said, well, I can't think of any besides Isaac. Yeah. He would have been a great physicist. I wonder why he went into biochemistry instead of science and astronomy, too.
Oh, I mean, the short answer is that his parents wanted him to go to medical school. Early on, he was just studying to be a doctor. And I think switching to chemistry was an obvious change. But no, he was a genius. You know, he was absolutely a prodigy, you know, and he made sure that everyone around him knew it. you know.
And he could type. He used a manual typewriter and he could type 70, 80 words a minute on a manual. I remember.
I mean, he became the most prolific author in American history. Right.
Doesn't he have something like 250 books?
Well, it depends on how you count them. His personal count was 400, which is astonishing in itself. And I always say this, he was probably the first science fiction writer I ever heard of. You know, he's probably the first science fiction writer I could recognize, you know, and I think he's actually still, you know, I think if he went on the street and showed his picture to people, I think he's actually more recognizable even now, 25 years after he died, than a lot of living novelists would be. Absolutely a mainstream celebrity.
he's so broad in his abilities too. Not only was he a professor of biochemistry, but he wrote science books about even space and physics. And he, I have a book on my bookshelf where he explained the Bible.
Yeah.
The Old and New Testament. That's an incredible thick work of art.
Yeah. Yeah. No, his goal was always to get to the point where he could write about anything, whatever he wanted. Yeah, right. Because he wrote history, he loved literature. He was a real polymath.
What do you think is his most enduring influence on modern American life?
Oh, that's a good question. So the work that he did with Campbell during the period I'm talking about. So this is when Asimov is very young, right? He's 19, 20, 21. And I mean, the two things that I think will last forever are the three laws of robotics and the idea of psychohistory from the Foundation series. There are the idea that you can develop a science of forecasting the future. And both of these ideas, I think, are incredibly compelling. And they came out of his work with Campbell. I mean, Campbell and Asimov would meet once a month. And, Campbell was in some ways the first to articulate the three laws. He was the first to kind of, want to explore the idea of psychohistory or of exact prediction of the future. And so that partnership ended up producing, within a very narrow window of time, these ideas that I think are still relevant today.
I think Apple's picked up as one of its original TV projects, the Foundation series. I remember that from the article I wrote the other day. That's going to be fascinating.
Yeah, well, it's like maybe the third attempt to adapt that project into some other medium. And I'm very curious because those books have amazing elements, but they're not action-packed. They are not books that naturally translate well to film or television. So I can't wait to see what happens.
Yeah, me too. Okay, moving on. L. Ron Hubbard. I was surprised to see him on your list instead of maybe a few other authors like Arthur Clarke. But So tell us about L. Ron Hubbard and why he was included.
Everyone who sees that title, one of their first reactions is, what's Hubbard doing there? And it's a great question. It's a legitimate question. And my answer is that, so this is a book about Campbell, right? Campbell is kind of the central figure here. And Hubbard and Campbell worked together closely for years. I mean, Hubbard was incredibly important to Campbell, even more important than Asimov in some ways, as a writer and as a partner. So you can't really tell Campbell's story without telling Hubbard's story. Campbell and Hubbard worked together, on the ideas that eventually became Scientology, and that's a huge part of the story too. But most of all, Hubbard, his stories have not held up very well. He was not that great a writer compared to someone like Heinlein. But as a personality, as someone who made a huge impression on the people around him, he was a major part of the science fiction community. And everyone who talks about that period, they say that Hubbard would just dominate the room. No one who met him ever forgot that experience. and so just on like the level of personality and kind of as this force of nature, he was part of that story.
Have you had any pushback from reviewers about the inclusion of Hubbard in over and above your connection to Campbell?
Not at all. I mean, anyone I think who reads the book comes away with, the accurate impression, which is that Hubbard was obviously an immensely flawed, figure. That's very complicated afterlife. But he absolutely merits his inclusion here.
All right. Well, I've saved the best for last. Robert Anson Heinlein, my all-time favorite author when I was growing up. My favorite novel from him is Glory Road.
Oh, yeah.
And he was, for the listeners, a naval officer, went to the Naval Academy. As I understand it, sustained an injury, I don't remember what, that forced him to retire from the Navy and to make a living, to put food on the table. He started writing short stories and science fiction. And so take it away, Alec.
Yeah, I mean, Heinlein is also, I think, my favorite writer, my favorite science fiction writer. I think he was sort of head and shoulders above anybody else who was working at that time. And Campbell recognized it, I mean, the amazing thing about Heinlein's story is that you were saying, that he kind of turned to writing as, like another job. Like he had tried several things at that point in his career. And he kind of wrote a story for Astounding impulsively. He said, okay, I'll try it. He wrote, struck a lifeline, and it took about a week to finish it. and he submitted it to Campbell, and Campbell bought it. He bought his first submission to Astounding. And what I always find amazing is the fact that I think if Campbell had turned that story down, Heinlein might have just given up because he had other things going on, right? He could have gone into politics again. He could have done any number of things, right?
Might have become an engineer, aeronautical engineer, as I understand.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, he certainly had other options. But, you know, the fact that Campbell, you know, saw what was there and took that story, you know, obviously changed the history of science fiction. And I think from the beginning, Campbell recognized that Heinlein was basically the writer he'd been looking for years. You know, he was sort of the ideal science fiction writer. And I think it really comes through when you read those stories today.
Heinlein had the ability to create characters that really inspired you and just completely put you in rapture about what you wanted to do for the future. And it set me on a course in physics and astronomy. I remember reading The Door into Summer, which might be my second favorite after Glory Road. And it just, you know, he had the robotic vacuum cleaner. And he had the electronic drafting board. He was very visionary.
Yeah, well, you know, he talks, you know, so the ones that I think about a lot are the juvenile novels that he wrote for young adults.
Rocket Ship Galileo.
Have Space People Travel. You know, these are books he wrote as propaganda, he said. He said, I'm going to get people to become engineers and scientists, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, these books are the best form of propaganda imaginable for those fields.
I have all of Heinlein's books. I even have all the juveniles, which I managed to buy in hardback, and it's a great collection.
Oh, yeah. And those books are great.
So what do you think Heinlein's lasting legacy is?
That's a great question. I mean, I think he has defined, I mean, his career was so complicated, you know, I mean, he went through at least three distinct stages as a writer. And so when you think about Heinlein's legacy, you have to ask yourself, okay, so which one, right? Because you've got the future history that he was writing in the late 30s, early 40s. You've got sort of this middle period with the juveniles, and you've got these really interesting kind of mature late books. You know, I think a lot depends on which one you happen to encounter first. Right. I mean, someone who encounters Heinlein first through a book like Stranger in a Strange Land is going to have a very different impression of him than someone who reads Have Space Suit Will Travel or Starship Troopers or, you know, The Path Through Tomorrow. So, you know, he was so versatile that I think no matter what you do in science fiction, as long as you get past kind of his reputation, which I think is very daunting for some people, you'll find something there that will be really instructive and inspiring.
Stranger in a Strange Land tells the story of a Martian who was born on Mars and comes to Earth and is a little awkward. And I think I've seen several science fiction movies lately in the last 5 or 10 years about young men who grew up in a Martian colony and come back to Earth. So I think that's another part of his inspiration on modern life.
Yeah, man, that's another book that's been under option probably by Hollywood continuously for the past 30 years, you know, and I see rumors occasionally of there being a miniseries or some other kind of project, but so far, nothing.
Okay, so this book, Astounding, tells the story of these men, these science fiction writers, and their life and times and their influence and relationship to each other. Tell us more about the details of the book. Who's the publisher? How much does it cost? When does it come out? We can all get all that, and I'll put it in the show notes too.
Oh, yeah, thank you. So I have my copy of it right here, the full title is Astounding, John W. Campbell, Isaac Asimov, Robert A. Heinlein, L. Ron Hubbard, and the Golden Age of Science Fiction. It is published by Day Street Books, an imprint of HarperCollins. It costs $28.99, and you can buy it anywhere, starting on October 23rd.
So I'll put the Amazon link in the show notes.
That'd be great.
All right. So good luck with that. Can I get a copy?
Absolutely. Just give me your address.
All right, cool. So tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish, if they want to congratulate you or send you a note or ask a question. What's the best way to contact you?
Yeah, so I'm online. So if you go to either search for my name or go to nebelali.com, my contact information is there. So I love hearing from readers. I've met amazing people through this project, fans and writers. So, you know, please reach out.
Great. Well, thanks again for being on the show. It was delightful. And this is a great story, and I wish you all the luck with the book.
Oh, thank you very much.
Folks, you've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll be back next week.